Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you tuned in. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Mass transit is all around you, and it's growing. You see the buses and trains running and new lines being built, and we're discouraging the single occupancy car with toll lanes and bike lanes and diminishing parking spaces. Is this a settled debate? We've declared a war on cars? Well, there are signs of discontent. The state Senate is holding hearings into whether Sound Transit misled lawmakers about the size of its ballot measure. A Republican running for Congress says if he goes to D.C., he'll fight the taxes that pay for Sound Transit. And a traffic planner who once predicted tolls on virtually all of our freeways and main arterials now says that probably won't happen because there's been so much opposition to the tolls on 405. So I want to know, and I thought you might want to know, where are we on transit? Is there a significant, important public backlash, or has the transit train left the station? My guests today, Maria Frost, Transportation Director at the Free Market Washington Policy Center. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Bill. Thank you for having me.
And Jessen Farrell, former Washington State Representative, former Director of the Transportation Choices Coalition. Jessen, good to see you again. Thank you for coming.
Good morning.
You have a little volume button there, a knob over there in case you need it to hear Maria better. First of all, Maria, voters have approved multiple times have approved Sound Transit train lines and buses, those voter packages. Is there a chance that any of those lines are not going to be built because of this opposition we're hearing about?
Well, I can't speak to that. I do think the investigation that is happening now, the second hearing of which is in an hour today, is merited, and it's important. Just because the measure passed does not mean that continued scrutiny and accountability of the agency is not important, and I think that's really what legislators are trying to do on behalf of the public, since Sound Transit is not directly accountable to them.
What's the number one issue that needs scrutinizing and accountability right now when it comes to Sound Transit?
Well, today, the issue on the table is whether or not Sound Transit participated in the campaign. I think that is really important. As you saw, there was a fantastic article in the Seattle Times by Briar Dudley on transportation choices and Sound Transit's involvement with that. We've put out a study as well on Sound Transit's giving to nonprofits leading up to the investigation. So I'm hoping that the investigation brings about meaningful legislation that the purpose of which is not to stick it to Sound Transit, but to make the agency better and to make them more responsive to voters, to make voters feel like they actually have a voice. I think that's what's really missing, and I think that any kind of movement in that more democratic direction is to Sound Transit's advantage.
Okay, Jessen Farrell, you used to be director of Transportation Choices Coalition, which the Seattle Times has reported on. Is there any lack of transparency that you would admit to when it comes to this Sound Transit voter package?
Well, I would say that this is really a national Republican play. They love their investigations. It's a great way to hide the ball and talk about other things. The fact of the matter is Sound Transit is delivering trains. It's delivering buses across the region. People are using this transit. And there are a lot of folks who are anti-transit and angry about that. And so this is an opportunity to maybe try to change the subject. But at the end of the day, people in this region want choices. They don't want to sit in traffic. They want environmental sustainable transportation options, and that's what this is about. Sound Transit is one of the most audited agencies in the country, and it has a AAA bond rating, and that's because it is delivering projects in a transparent and accountable way.
Maria, I mentioned a whole bunch of kinds of transit, trains and buses and bikes and toll lanes. Is there anything that the Puget Sound is doing when it comes to de-emphasizing the solo car that you oppose?
Yes, we definitely oppose the disproportionate focus on public transportation and congestion management only. I think when folks talk about transportation choices, they fail to recognize or at least admit that a great portion of the region really depends on vehicles for mobility. A lot of working families transit doesn't work for them. 83% of the region is projected to continue to travel by car by 2040. And according to Sound Transit's own numbers, ST3 is going to service less than 1% of boardings by 2040. So I think the better solution is to focus on congestion relief, not management, which is more equitable and fair because it would get everybody moving. That includes buses, that includes drivers and freight and emergency responders. And I think that is a far more fair and responsive approach that gets really everybody moving and respects the freedom of mobility for all people, not just people who take public transportation.
So, Maria, are you objecting to transit taking up space that cars could use, or a lack of building more roads, or misspent money? What's the issue?
Well, part of the issue is that we're not offering capacity to drivers at the rate at which they demand it. And I know that the argument is, well, if we build more roads, then people will just fill it up. But the problem with that is we're not even meeting current demand. I think it's totally inappropriate to talk about a latent demand. In fact, Sound Transit's willing to supply $100,000 parking spaces to a public they say demands parking capacity, and yet they deny that the same economic principle should apply to drivers who are demanding roads. So I think, and we saw that when the tanker accident in Seattle, the Seattle Times editorial board came out with a great piece talking about the problem is not with bike lanes. It's the problem is taking capacity from drivers and giving it and turning it into bike lanes. There has to be a way that we can provide for mobility for everybody in the region without necessarily at the expense of one another,
okay.
If that makes sense.
Jessen, you're well aware of the frustration people feel when they're sitting on clogged roads. What do you say to these objections to public transportation
that's
playing out?
I'd say that, I love congestion relief too. And what that looks like for me is hopping on a train at Husky Stadium, taking a 4-minute ride to Capitol Hill or an 8-minute ride to Westlake, and knowing I'm going to get there on time instead of sitting in traffic on I-5. That is what congestion relief looks like to me. And I would say, look, I am a mom. I have 3 kids. I don't take transit to every single trip we're going to take. When I'm taking my kids to soccer, we drive. But I think that most of us want a transportation system that is reliable, that has different options depending on where you're trying to get to at different times of the day. People are taking transit when it counts, which is during rush hour, which is during those times of the day when our roads are filled up. And those are the times of the day when we need transit to be working. And quite frankly, people are making the choice to get on transit. The trains are full, the buses are full, and people want more. People want this to get built faster. You talk to people in Ballard, in Tacoma, in Bellevue, in Redmond, all across the region. People are clamoring for more transit. This is not about a war on cars. It's not about, getting people to necessarily leave, their lifestyles behind. But it is around lifestyles that people actually want, which is not sitting stuck in traffic, which is time you're not spending with your kids, time you're not spending exercising, doing all those things that you want to be doing.
Maria, I'm not taking sides on this debate, but as a personal anecdote, I find that when the 550 comes as often as it does and the Link light rail comes as often and reliably as it does, and now bike shares are all over me. I'm tripping all over them. It's easier to use the dang things than walk around them. I'm using those 3 legs to get to work because there's so much of it. It has become convenient for me personally. What about the idea that the more transit is built, the more people use it, the fewer solo cars, the better the congestion?
First and foremost, I want to say I think that transit has a very, very important role in our region. We have a good transit system with King County Metro. Our bike shares have been very, very successful, especially the most recent one. I think all of that is good, and I'm not trying to demean that in any way. But I do think that the build it and they will come approach, generally speaking, produces underperforming systems. And this is important to consider when we're talking not just about folks in the urban core, but the people paying for this include people in places like Puyallup and Ording, kind of the outskirts of the Sound the Sound Transit Taxing District. And for them, this really does not work. And we're seeing more and more people who are mega commuters, people like me, who commute to South Seattle by car. I mean, I spend hours on the road, and unfortunately, public transportation does not work for me. That being said, I think it's important, like I said, that we provide for mobility for all people, not just folks for whom public transportation works.
And I would say, you know, there is a massive parking problem in Puyallup because people are trying to get on that train. I lived in Tacoma, commuted by train to downtown Seattle. Those trains were packed. And I bet if you talk to certain Republican senators who live in Lakewood or potentially Kent, they take the train up to Seattle, too. It is not a partisan issue. It is a mobility issue.
Sure.
One size fits all is not what we're going after. We're trying to have a reliable, resilient system that has a lot of different ways to get around. And I think that's what people really want.
Maria, what about the pay-by-mile system that planners are considering, where we use technology to charge you for the distance you drive? Do you think that'll be well adopted, a backlash? What do you think?
We have some serious concerns about that. I know that a road usage charge is very much a part of the Puget Sound Regional Council's Vision 2040 plan. They would like to see 53% of investments going to transit and 17% of investments going to highways, and the road usage charge is a part of that. One of the things that would make a mileage tax, I think, or one of the things that makes it attractive to government is that it could potentially not be protected by the 18th Amendment, which means that the money that drivers pay, government would get to decide how that should be used, and that may not necessarily be towards roads, and it would fail to be a user fee and would become a general tax. We are very, very concerned about that, and I think less money would actually go to roads and maintenance, which we so desperately need right now.
Okay, Maria Frost, Transportation Director at the Free Market Washington Policy Center, got the first word. Justin Farrell, former state representative, former director of the TCC. Last words on where we are right now in our adoption of transit versus some people's frustration with it.
Well, the state and the region have made massive investments in the transportation system. The state passed the largest transportation package in state history that had an ample investment in roads. So folks like Maria, who might be concerned about that, there's a lot of money for that. And then, of course, voters in the region voted to approve new transit, new additional light rail lines, new additional trains, new additional bus routes across the region. Those are being delivered right now, and they're underway, and they're not going away. And in fact, people want more, and they want it faster. And I think that's what we should be putting our efforts towards instead of old-fashioned arguments about roads versus transit. We've moved past that.
Justin Farrell, former state representative, Maria Frost, Washington Policy Center. Thanks to you both for this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
KUOW's The Record. Moving on, we're going to talk about the food on your plate and how did it get there. It's part food, it's part culture, it's part marketing. We're going to talk about Copper River salmon and oysters and, I don't know, maybe golden milk and maybe prunes versus dried plums. All kinds of food trends coming up. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in here to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. It is no accident that you eat what you do. Food trends are partly about food, also about culture and marketing. This week, one of the Northwest's great food marketers has died. John Rowley's work is a big reason you eat Copper River salmon and Olympia oysters. Here to talk about John and marketing and deliciousness and trendiness, Seattle restaurateur Peter Lewis, who is the founder of Campagna. Good to see you, Peter.
Nice to see you, Bill.
Author Xiaoqing Chow, whose cookbook is Chinese Soul Food. Good to see you again, Xiaoqing.
Thanks, Bill. Good to be here.
Let's start, Peter. You and I both knew Xiaoqing. I imagine you knew John Rowley as well.
Yes, absolutely.
I certainly did. Peter, I know you did. How did John put Copper River salmon on our plates?
Before we get into that story, let me just I'd like to extend my sincere condolences to John's family, his daughters, Megan and Caitlin. It's a great loss, and there's so many people whom John touched. And some of the tributes that have been posted are very, very moving tributes. He leaves a great vacuum, but the legacy is what we have come to inherit, and it's an extraordinary legacy. And most people associate that legacy first and foremost with Copper River salmon.
Mm-hmm.
John introduced Copper River salmon to the market in 1983. But to understand what that meant, you look back at his early life, because he had an extraordinary upbringing, spending time as a kid on the coast with a frying pan and a stick of butter and salt and pepper.
On the coast foraging. With a frying pan?
With a frying pan, foraging for crab and fish and shellfish. He worked as a boy in high school, had his own fish cleaning concession at the mouth of the Columbia. He stole away before his high school graduation on a fishing boat, and in a way never looked back. He ended up going to Europe and tasted his first oyster and credited that event with having changed his life. And that led to his traveling all throughout Europe and looking at the way fishermen brought their fish to market. He kept asking himself, why does everything taste so much better in Europe than it does back home?
Good question.
And he spent time with fishermen and oystermen, and he went out. And what he realized is that what he was used to seeing in Alaska and in the Pacific Northwest were fishermen who would, you know, cast out seine nets and bring their fish in and throw them in the bottom of the boat, and they'd be put on conveyors. They were stacked. They were treated like sort of a junk commodity. And a lot of the fish that was being purveyed in restaurants, being sold in markets and being purveyed in restaurants in Seattle, were mishandled. So what he did, committed to bringing the techniques that he had seen in Europe to the Pacific Northwest, was to approach fishermen, in this case, salmon fishermen in Alaska, to bleed the fish when they were first brought in on line, so line-caught salmon, bleed the fish, ice them immediately, lay them out impeccably, in these shallow boxes with ice. They never were thrown on top of each other. They were treated with consummate respect. And the impetus was not only to bring beautiful product to the table in Seattle and across the Northwest, but also to give the fishermen themselves an opportunity to earn a viable livelihood. You know, you bring junk fish in, and it translates to really poor pricing.
I do want to tell people about Copper River salmon, because he found out that the people, the fishers who were bringing that that salmon in, weren't making the living off this beautiful fish that they could, right?
Right. That's right. So you know, he approached fishermen originally suggesting to them that they employ these techniques. They balked at the idea. And then within the year, they came back to him and said, we'd like to give it a try. And he packed up 300 pounds of Copper River salmon on an Alaska Airlines flight. He met the plane in Seattle, and he took the fish to Ray's Boathouse. And, you know, he described that fish as being more beautiful in death than it was in life.
Xiaoqing, is Copper River salmon worth, what is it, $50 a pound? Something like that? I guess it depends
on what your perspective is on that. I think that if you look at it from the standpoint of the producer, the person who is going out there to catch this fish, that is their livelihood. So you're paying for that person's effort to bring that fish to you.
And plus all the overhead that comes with transporting that from the source down to the lower 48.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you're looking at it strictly from a budget standpoint, that's hard to take sometimes. And then if you wait a little bit longer, deeper into the season, the prices come down a little bit. Or if you know how to cook, buy the whole fish. It's always mm-hmm. cheaper if you buy the whole fish. So it really depends on how you look at it. Some of that has to do with the demand, and the prices go up because of that. So that's economics.
The way that it came down to my brain, which can only hold so much, is that Alaska's cold, the fish need to be fat, and they're good and fat and oily, especially from the Copper River. Is that about it?
Yeah, I mean, they store up the fat so they can travel the long distance of the river. So mm-hmm. whether that is the Copper River or the Yukon River, the salmon biologically have to do that in order to spawn. So we catch them, the royal we catch them at the mouth of the river so that we get them when they're at that full flavor unctuousness that we love.
I used to participate in John Rowley's marketing. He would hold, remember the Oyster Olympics?
Sure.
At Ray's Boathouse. So they'd have shucking competitions. John Rowley taught me how to shuck with that blade. I used to compete in the slurping competition. At least a couple years. One time I brought chloroseptic as a kind of a prank. I'm juicing myself, you know, I'm deadening my, so that I can slurp more oysters, you know, so we kind of played with that.
Did it work?
I didn't win. I didn't win any of those years. I used to write little limericks and poems for the radio, and he asked me to write one for the Oyster Olympics. So I proclaimed it, and the only stanza I can remember is, if you want to be boringly fed, try a salad or burger instead. But for rapturous eating, there's nothing like feeding on something so recently dead.
Perfect.
And then I went and, you know, slurped away. What was his great interest in Olympia oysters, Peter?
Well, as was the case with the Copper River salmon, he knew that Olies had been consumed in the 19th century.
Olies?
Little Olympia.
Mm-hmm.
But in the early 80s, the only Olympia oysters you found were jarred. So he went out to the peninsula. This is a guy who always went to ground. He always went to source. He went to meet the oystermen and fishermen and farmers subsequently to find out what they were doing, how they were doing it, and if there might be some better way to bring that product to market. And he knocked on doors on the Olympic Peninsula and found, you know, people who had Olympias in their oyster beds. John worked extensively with the Taylor family at Taylor Shellfish Farms. And in, I want to say the middle of the 19th century, late 19th century, Olympias were raised on Taylor's shellfish beds in the South Sound. And so John got oyster seed, and they were reintroduced. And they became one of these crazes, you know, mm-hmm. these tiny little delicacies, these little pearls of oysters that people were fascinated by. And obviously, since you're a shucker, you know the great challenge that Olies provide to an oyster shucker. These are tiny little suckers to get open.
Yeah, and there may be blood.
There might be.
So we're talking about a craze for delicacies that has to do with freshness and flavor and locally sourced and passion. I'm wondering what you think of modern food trends. What drives a food trend now that either you love or you just roll your eyes at and wish it would be done because it's a fake?
You know, I think that there are a lot of factors that play into what becomes trendy. Nowadays, whether something is Instagrammable,
oh yeah,
definitely plays a role. I mean, if you look at your Instagram feed, there are a lot of overhead shots of food scenes, and everything is placed just so.
What's an Instagram celebrity food?
Usually it's some dish that they've just made, and then they take a piece of it out, and then they're crumbs or ingredients just placed exactly just right around the plate, and then the lighting is beautiful and all of that. So you start to see a lot of that, but it's also something, it could be something like the unicorn frappuccino that Starbucks had, that all of a sudden all these kids, because, you know, I mean, it was this crazy thing. It was a limited time drink, and everybody wanted to show off the fact that, oh yeah, they stood in line for that and they ordered it and their picture and put a hashtag on it.
Yes.
Right? So some of that plays into it. And then sometimes, you know, people want to, it's the chicken and the egg. Restaurant folks are always looking for something new because the customers want something new. But how do you really come up with something new? I mean, Peter knows from being in the restaurant business, it's like, well, all the really good stuff has already been invented. You know, how are you going to reinvent that?
Is that right? Peter, has there been no new food trend where you find that same kind of passion that we've been talking about with John and people like him?
There's nothing new.
Nothing new.
Nothing new. You know, I think even though we might associate John Rowley with some of these food crazes, what drove and impelled John, it was really an obsession, was his search for flavor, was his search for perfection in a given product. You know, while John certainly was involved with events like the Oyster Olympics, the Oyster Wine Competition, I don't think of John Rowley, and never thought of John Rowley, as a public relations marketing guru. He had no real interest in that. What he loved was finding the perfect product, working with farmers and fishermen to bring that product in its most pristine form to the market, and then introduce that product and share that product with people. There's the three quintessential words that John Rowley uttered probably more than any others were, "Here, taste this." People who experienced him in farmers markets, in his home, at restaurants, at events, were endlessly being handed some little morsel of a delicacy, whether it was a peach or a strawberry or a morel or a piece of salmon, with the words, "Here, taste this." He wanted to share. He had an almost childlike pleasure and delight in the experience of tasting perfect food. And he loved sharing that with people.
Seattle restaurateur Peter Lewis, founder of Campagna, author Xiaoqing Chao, her cookbook is Chinese Soul Food. Come back, let's talk more about food trends another time. Because I wanna know about why suddenly poke is poking me everywhere, and you know, and many other food trends. So let's do it again, okay?
Sounds good.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you. KUOW's The Record, coming right back. Thanks for tuning in. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Americans are arguing over who is intolerant. Liberals have called conservatives intolerant for a long time. Lately, some high-profile right-wingers are claiming, no, it's the liberal social justice warriors. They're the ones who won't tolerate dissent. Into that debate steps my next guest. University of Washington student Francis Lee moves in Seattle's leftist activist community. Francis is a queer, trans, Chinese American who says members of the left do sometimes intimidate their own with fear, the fear of seeming impure. Francis wrote an essay for a website run by queer feminists, and the essay is called "Excommunicate Me from the Church of Social Justice." Francis Lee, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you so much, Bill.
You wrote that there's an underlying current of fear in the Seattle activist community. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so what I mean is kind of the social anxiety and this fear when going into spaces where people identify themselves as radical or as activists or, you know, working for a certain cause like, you know, Black Lives Matter or for, you know, ending transphobia. And there's just such a rich culture of language and norms and behaviors in those spaces that, you know, if you're not familiar with those things going in, it can feel really daunting and exclusionary and alienating and, you know, like might turn you off from collaborating with people with whom you actually share a lot of values.
So Frances, how have you personally felt shut down or excluded or alienated?
I think a lot of the way I experienced that is through the use of language and the use of just like dominant beliefs in activist spaces. So, you know, like if you say, oh, you're being oppressive, that's kind of like this red flag of we don't like this person or what they're doing, and like we need to move away from them, right? With the language of social justice, it's this us versus them mentality. And in a lot of ways, it is, right? There are people who are very privileged and people who are not as privileged, and there's a whole spectrum, and we need to like talk about those distinctions. But at the same time, I think that we also have a lot in common, and like recognizing that, you know, that we have the capability to do good and that we love other humans and that we care about people other than ourselves, right? I think focusing on those things is what is going to be integral for having like a sustainable activist practice wherever it leads you.
You even compared your experience with Seattle activists to your experience with evangelical Christianity. What did you mean by that?
You know, this is all kind of based on my own personal life experience of growing up in an evangelical Christian household where my dad was a pastor. He actually still is a pastor. Just growing up with those set of rules about who I am in the world, what am I supposed to be doing there, and having that be just all I knew. You know, part of that was my experience in the church was that it was a very legalistic way of being in the world, right? There were these commandments I had to follow and, you know, sub-commandments that were attached to that. And there were these leaders who I had to, you know, confess my wrongdoings to or ask forgiveness for or just kind of seek help from. Like they were just like on a higher moral ground, so to speak. And so growing up, I just thought the whole point of life was to be good. And I know that a lot of parents kind of instill that in a more playful manner, but I took it very, very seriously, you know, because it had
to be either good or you're bad.
Exactly. And it, you know, it was tied to like your eternal destination, right? Which is the most intense thing ever to say to a kid, I think. And I kind of moved away from that when I went to college in Texas and kind of have been a little distant from, just don't identify as Christian anymore. But what was really telling to me was, you know, I was like, all right, I'm going to kind of start a new life and blaze a new path and choose my political values and get involved in activism and go hang out with activists and queer and trans people of color and all that good stuff. And definitely those spaces are my homes, you know, like my best friends I've met through doing activism and through like sharing our experiences of being transgender or being queer. And it's pretty much my whole social community. At the same time, because I'm so deeply entrenched in those groups, I get to see kind of like the dark underbelly, if you will, of people behaving badly or people taking good ideas and using them in a way that hurts other people, right? And so the connections I was seeing was that there was like this set of rules to follow of like how to be a good activist and how to be a pure activist. And that really rang some bells for me because this whole idea of purity and goodness and maybe we'll say perfection is very dogmatic, right? And it's totally what Christianity and other religions like that preach and, you know, try to use to control people's behavior.
So, Frances, when you talk about a dogmatism or intolerance among progressive activists, it reminds me of, You're talking about it so far. We're talking about privately inside the community, you know, in online forums. But it reminds me of what right wingers say about social justice warriors being publicly intolerant and intolerant on campus, for example. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that they're like the right wing, conservative, alt right, Nazi, whatever, their critiques of at least what they perceive as social justice activists and lefty people are like aren't totally off base, you know? Like some of the most vocal people you see kind of parading around with these social justice causes are very aggressive, you know, not necessarily willing to sit down and have a conversation. And definitely online, just like shut people down left and right who don't agree with them exactly. Now, I'm not saying that I disagree with them and their tactics. And again, I'll say that there's specific tactics that are useful for specific situations, right? You can't just say a blanket statement, never be aggressive, never stand up for yourself, never say anything, right? And so, you know, I think for a while I was like, oh, well, of course the right would say that. They're just trying to, you know, bring us down or whatever. But, you know, the more I thought about it, the more I realized that it really is important to kind of have a sense of how the rest of the world is understanding what we're trying to do.
I wonder if there's another way to look at this, Frances, from inside your activist community. I could imagine someone saying, look, you sound like you just don't like conflict, Frances. I'm giving my opinion. I'm being clear that request for a biologically female roommate is not okay. And you should be able to take that in and not look at it like I'm drumming you out of the club. What do you think?
Yeah. So, I mean, I will say conflict is hard for me. You know, I just, as someone who previously just kind of flew under the radar and just kind of did what I was told to do, right? The way that I was trained, you know, growing up evangelical Christian. But the older I get, you know, and the more situations I found myself in where there is this kind of conflict or kind of observing it on the side happen, is that so much bad is said about conflict. And conflict can also be very painful to experience, right? You know, you're being challenged and you have to defend yourself, or you feel like you have to defend yourself. But I really see those sites of conflict, especially one community, as like opportunities and areas for like going deeper and having like a very rich conversation about, okay, so now I've identified some clashing values, and let's just talk about it, you know, and let's be together in person and talk it through. Because I think it's so hard to work those things online because everyone is behind a screen and it's kind of responding in a way that where they're just like performing wokeness, I guess. That's kind of a phrase some people use. And
performing wokeness, meaning I need to show everybody how aware I am. Mm-hmm. It's almost a status thing, right?
Yeah. And I think it comes
or a defensiveness. Out of, what do you think?
Yeah. I think it comes out of insecurity rather than maybe feeling really good about yourself and where you are. Because these things happen, right? People will challenge each other and say, you're XYZ, and then, you know, that hurts someone's reputation online. And then it's just hard to recover when someone, like, tries to destroy your reputation, right? So I am really trying to work through a relationship with conflict that is more open and embracing of conflict in a community setting, not just, like, straight up in the political, just in public. And to think about talking through these things, talking through ideas, talking through experiences, and creating, I guess, a little bit of distance between certain ideas and like my own identity.
So, Frances, I hear you saying you want to embrace conflict. You want what's great about conflict. So when you write this essay, and at least the headline writer calls it "Excommunicate me from the Church of Social Justice," you're not turning your back on your progressive activist friends, but you want what? What do you want them to do differently?
Yeah, so that title was kind of a tongue-in-cheek title. I wanted to name the article that because I was just really fed up with all the things that I talked about in my article, just the exclusionary tactics of activist communities. And as someone who feels very strongly about those values and who feels like there's a home there, I wanted to kind of dare people to kick me out for saying something about it publicly, right? For making a critique and saying, I'm in here, but I also am like really unhappy about these things, and I think that they're probably not great.
And has that happened? Do you find yourself being kicked out?
That hasn't happened. I'll say that hasn't happened yet. But what has been really remarkable is that people have been privately reaching out to me to talk about the article, to say things like, oh, you know, I felt this way for such a long time, but I thought it was just me, or I didn't know how to talk about it because I thought people would kick me out, you know, just like what the title is saying, just countless stories like that. Which, you know, number one, is very heartening that I'm not the only one either, and that we've all identified that this is an issue. But number two, also kind of disappointing that it's such a widespread issue, as I've gotten, you know, listeners who have emailed me and contacted me from as far away as like Australia and Scotland, who are like, this is a huge problem. Thank you for writing this.
So what's going to change?
So a lot of times, I think when people start to do activism or say, I care about these issues, I care about saving the earth, I care about XYZ, that there's kind of this assumption that because you care about like a good value, you're just going to, everything you do for it will be good, right? And clearly, like, that's not the case. And I think that's what my essay is trying to get at, is we're like, okay, like, we all have our hearts in the right place, but maybe like some of the things we do to get to those goals might be a little suspect, you know? And I think it's important to separate like our methods from our values, right? And so an ethics of activism, you know, might look like cultivating just a curiosity about new ideas, right? So, and just understanding that ideas evolve and change as the world changes. So, you know, getting attached to any particular one idea is probably kind of dangerous and, you know, is not really how, I guess, like personal growth works.
If you're just tuning in, you might think Francis Lee and I are talking about a spirit of generosity and understanding even toward conservatives and Trump voters, and actually we're talking about that, I think, and also generosity toward people who might think a lot like us. I think in Seattle sometimes the conversation is about who's activist enough.
Absolutely.
Who's progressive enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think those questions are very derailing to, well, what's the point of having a progressive politics if you're so invested in your own identity formation?
Francis Lee wrote the essay Excommunicate Me from the Church of Social Justice. Thanks for coming in and telling us about it, Francis.
Thanks so much, Bill.
And you're listening to KUOW, and you trust what you hear from NPR and KUOW and programs like The Record. That's why you listen, and that's a good reason to give to KUOW during our fall membership drive. Your contribution is going to keep this important news and information coming your way. If you give us a call right now, it's 206-543-9595 or online. It's kuow.org. I'm David Hyde. I'm a reporter here at KUOW, and I'm here with the host of The Record, Bill Radke.
We are so happy to be able to bring you the conversations that matter to the Puget Sound area, and so proud, actually, to come during the pledge drive and say, you know, we've got this unique way of funding KUOW and keeping us independent. Right now, we have this challenge from a Broadcaster Circle donor who wants you to call 543-9595 or to click KUOW.org and become a member. That board member is a Broadcaster Circle member, is offering KUOW $30,000, $30,000. And our goal just this hour to stay on track to meet that big challenge, We have 50 calls to go to meet that goal. 50 calls to go and wrapping up the hour. So please, KUOW.org.
And if that's not enough, there is the Stand With The Facts mug, sure to become a collector's item in my house, I'm thinking, because I've got the BBC mug.
Mm-hmm.
I've got other KUOW public radio mugs. If you're a mug collector like I am, give us a call right now. Today only, it's a $120 level gift, the Stand With The Facts KUOW NPR mug. It's going up to $180 tomorrow. So you can get in on that right now by calling 206-543-9595 or going online. It's KUOW.org.
And if you are a collector of stories and points of view and opinions and facts, Stand With The Facts and pledge now, KUOW.org, 543-9595. Thank you so much for your support.